Okay. Firstly, thank you all for taking care of the Dana talk together. Yuha as well, thank you. Really appreciate you doing that. I got to go in the sauna. And the lake. Hope you had a really kind afternoon. Enjoyable practice. And enjoyable doesn't mean everything has to be lovely, right? Enjoyable in practice means there can be the joy that comes from seeing and understanding is something so precious. So this evening I'd like to our last night, I'd like to try to offer something that I hope might serve you in whatever your future path holds in a small way. I would wish, and we would wish for you, wherever your path goes, whatever life asks of you, that you might have the refuge, real refuges, and support for your practice to be able to turn to those refuges. A refuge or refuges that give you shelter from the storms, and that also allow you respite to regather such that your imagination may be restored for you to be able to continue in ways that are onward leading. One of the things that is increasingly crucial for myself is actually, I think as I get older, the Dharma refuges become more and more important, actually. All of them, all of the ways of looking that unbind suffering, that point to emptiness in ways that open more love, becomes all increasingly more important for me as I get older, as some of the personality defenses loosen, and as the world offers us its cries, inner and outer cries and crises. So one of the things in that is the soul-making ways of looking. Of course, I'm a teacher in that, and they are particularly important to me. So when last night when we explained, I began to explain the Eros Psyche Logos dynamic. Just one thing to know technically before I get into the kind of meat of the talk is that more and more things that are important to us, anything that is important to a soul, anything that is important to a soul can get woven into this Eros Psyche Logos dynamic. It can be swept into that dynamic. And when something that's important to us, birth, death, relationships, crises, beauty, poetry, this issue, that beloved, materiality, non-materiality, anything that's important to us can get swept in, and when it does, it is woven in and create and discovered into soul through our participation. So I'm just putting that there. And even when Rob was dying, and I'm aware I've really spoken much more about Rob than I typically do on a retreat, to my interest, that I've done that. It's always a kind of fine line to tell the stories of the beautiful founder without sort of like making that too strange or weird to do that. But one of the things, even as he, in those last 6 weeks, one of the things that would bring him delight when it was actually really difficult was like sharing about practice. And something that, you know, it's like, oh, this happened in the soul making. He goes, yes, this is what we would expect. More and more gets woven in to the Eros Psyche Logos dynamic, and then he's out of it. It's like that was the delight more and more we can get woven into that, more and more of what's important to you, if this becomes the path for you. When Eros, remember in that diagram, in that theatre, that loving desire for more is able to be in that full switch on of loving desire for more without pulling or pushing, unapologetic in that desire and yet so sensitive that it's so attuned at the same time, powerfully unapologetic but utterly sensitive, then this enables creations of senses of self, other and world that we won't have seen before, not only for their own sake, but tonight really from the principle of what is it that will help us navigate in these next years and decades together alone. So I will offer a particular image, but I invite you into that image, of course, if it speaks to you in any ways. And I invite you into the images for yourself that speak to you of more. And tonight I'm going to kind of include another dimension in the what's woven into the Eros psychologos dynamic than we've spoken about. I think we've hinted at me. Images have the power, as they become more and more imaginal, to beckon us onward, to call us onward. Perhaps because they're so beautiful to us that they allow us to kind of line up like iron filings before a magnet, like Eros with their arrow pointing towards what it is that's right at the point. That in that beauty and in that emptiness are robust enough, somehow robust, extraordinarily robust and flexible enough that we can meet what seems to be asked of us. So before the image, I'll begin it with a piece of my history from a few years ago. Less than 3 years ago, somewhere in 2022, I began a 3-month short sabbatical in mid-May. And my task was to read the copious notes that Rob had left. Hundreds and hundreds of pages, I'd read them before, that documented his and my work together. As you can imagine, if you've listened to him, very thorough. Very thorough. Thank God for the thoroughness. But not only thorough, there were many, many things. And my task, one thing I promised that he was insistent upon, was that I would write my part of that story, and it wasn't just his voice in that story. It was important. I think it's important too. Even if writing isn't my water that I swim in normally. But I struggled as I read the notes. I struggled to find my bearings. I was like, what on earth how do I relate to this part? Not because it was so complex, but because of the all kinds of reasons. How do I find my bearings in all of this? So I will begin shortly with my practice of where I start to look for my bearings in relation to all that writing that he left. It's also my writing from the time as well, was all in there, all together. But as I was leaving to go on the sabbatical, and I went, somebody lent me their little caravan for a few weeks, at the same time I was tidying up the other work that I had to do, as you do before you go off on retreat or somewhere else. And I'm one of the guiding teachers for One Earth Sangha, which is a web Sangha, making Dharma responses to the poly-meta crises. how to speak about that. Really, and it's one earth sangha, so they have a particular ecological and environmental lean in that attention to the polycrisis. So I was just finishing off a piece of work, and one of the pieces of work they asked the teachers, on the guiding teachers, was to share some words about how we saw what is the concept eco-dharma. Eco-dharma has become a concept, but the dharma as related to eco, however you understand the word eco. And just to write a page or two of what would be our eco-dharma, what would be our offering of eco-dharma. Because there's not going to be just one, we need many things as we go along. And so this is what I began to write before the image. This is what I was beginning to write just as I was heading into the sabbatical. And so this is directly, mostly reading from what I wrote. We see, as probably all of you know, new normals of breakdowns. Fire, drought, destruction of environments, species loss. Injustices, destructions, authoritarianism, technocracies, crises, disinformations, extractions from peoples and planets. That we are knowingly destroying the conditions for certain kinds of life on Earth, and maybe human life on Earth. And what is it when I say that, which probably you're all very sharply aware of? What is it about, what images of that, these that we enter into with the of this predicament, what are the places that really get in and touch you? What are the images that get in? And I don't mean imaginal images. I mean, what are the facts or the images that get in? I read, there's many. There's so much, it's hard to take it all in, but sometimes when I cycle from my house and within 10 years, I don't have to wear glasses anymore because there's no insects that smack into my face. I don't have to wear glasses anymore when I cycle on the lane because there's barely occasional insect now that smacks me in the face when I ride. What is it for you that gets in? One of the relatively recent IPCC reports, again, it's not with emotional language, it's with quite precise technical language. And just breathe, I invite us to breathe. We're heading home tomorrow and we're very sensitive right now. So really taking care of the heart here, but as you may know, with 2.5 degrees Celsius, which is really easily going in that direction, rise. That by 2050, up to 86 million people in sub-Saharan Africa will have to move because the land will not be suitable for food. Or is it one of our Dharma friends, actually, who has a young daughter, who soberly said, yeah, he's a doctor, he knows the science, he said, he wasn't catastrophizing, he said, but there is a more greater chance for her than certainly for me that she will die prematurely in civil war or epidemic. I could go on. Let's just breathe together with that and hold that a little bit more before I move into how Eros Psyche Logos meets It's not just a kind of fun Greek concept. Let's just breathe with wherever you're touched, or maybe not, maybe it's not. But wherever. And let's breathe together in that, at the very, very, very least, that we could have our bodies available. And our arms, if I let my arms soften having said those things, it's like, ooh. And breathing out. And I may not have touched yet the image that speaks out to you in your heart in all of this. And as you breathe here, may we support ourselves not to collapse. Not to collapse in the center, but to keep opening the energy body out. If we are to not only remain sane, but actually be able to not only find beacons of sanity, but also potentially be beacons of sanity. So it's epic proportions. Epic proportions, you know, like when I was reflecting, and this is, as I go into the writing, what I finished up my writing, crises that sort of echo the proportions, the epic proportions from myths and legends that, you know, I thought belonged back there. In the Bible law, you know, in some myth. A crisis of biblical proportions, we might say. Already being faced by many. And I'm grateful now I'm reading, I'm grateful for the many eco-dharmas and the ways in to be able to turn toward this with wisdom and compassion. To resonate with that act in response and stretch in response. And all the intelligent levels at policy and technology and economy. I bow to the multiple intelligences that birth multiple solutions at all levels. And I was asked to share what occurs to me here as an eco-dharma. So I looked it up, even though I thought I remembered, and I looked up eco once again. And we're in the same language family as we've been all week, from oikos. Maybe we can have the eros, psyche, logos, oikos dynamic. Maybe. Oikos is where eco comes from in the Greek. Home, it means home. It means home. So the first question I asked myself, what is home? Home is such a deep concept in the human psyche, and different answers in different spiritual traditions about what is home. Different answers from the scientific traditions, different subjective senses as what is home to you? And home in the best sense to me is where I can belong, where I can be myself, where there is refuge from the storm, where we can be nourished, where the defences can soften, where we are restored for work. And I asked myself, what would I say is the most meaningful, trustworthy conception of home that I know? I recognise that many eco-dharmas are needed, with various interpretations of what home is, be it, you know, the traditions that say awareness is your home, right? Or the planet is your home. Or the land is your home. Locality is your home. The human family is your home. The more than human family is your home. Home is where the heart is. And I found out as I asked that my Dharma of home, my eco-dharma, my most trustworthy conception of home is the one where the concept of home is the whole cosmos. And where cosmos is not just the stars and the planets and the sky, but where cosmos has become image, where cosmos is blessed and beautiful and dimensional and mysterious and loving, and somewhere where somehow something more is possible. A Dharma of home for me is where the word cosmos, another Greek word, refers not only to the stars and the skies and the endless space. No, not that idea only. Not cosmos, that is a synonym for the Roman word universe, which has become more common. Where in the universe we are a small thing, in a big thing. As my friend Jill said when we were 17, walking back from school late in the dark, gosh, we're such a small thing in such a big thing, as in her marvelous way. And I was like, oh, come on, let's get on the bus. Right? That small thing in the big thing, beautiful, beautiful, but that's not what I'm talking about here. Even if it is a generous and vast notion. In that notion, sometimes space becomes primary. And that is not what I'm talking about either. That is not my most compelling version of home. In this proposal, eco, home as cosmos, is where we can be really, really intimate. With beloved othernesses, where we have an intimate relationship as cosmos, through cosmos, with cosmos, through the way we participate with our ways of looking. In imaginal encounters with inner images and outer sense contact, did any of you sense that today or practice with world as icon of seeing that where we are and what we are, there is more here than any story we can tell? Cosmos is a home where space and time are soft and elastic, and where the sense of eternality lets me see the world as icon, and where I am humbled and exalted in the same moment. So this kind of eco, this kind of home, is the eco-dharma that I want. And maybe at this proportion, for those who may need and want a story that is epic, that is legend, a mythos that is grand but not grandiose, that is really grand but deeply humbling. So that those who wish for such a home, that we may not just live through whatever comes with our hearts intact. That would be really good if we can. Can we live through whatever difficulties on any level with our hearts intact? This is already a great service. Not only our hearts intact, but our hearts with an eye, E-Y-E, an eye of the heart that can see and sense and restore and open and expand more beauty, sacredness, meaningfulness, dimensionality, imagination, and soul. So I'm wondering, as I just get to this point, I'm wondering if we have the energy for this tonight. Or if the sauna, well, you do, you'll be concerned. We can do it. Well, that's great. That's really clear. I do as well. And maybe it's been a long day, right? And this isn't me doing a drum roll thing. This is really like genuinely checking if the sauna and the heat and the and all of that, if this this can, if this, if I need to kind of praise it a little bit, what I have in mind. But and that's a really a genuine question this time, actually. Okay, so I'll keep checking in with you, because I know that was probably, I feel actually quite bright after the sauna, because I got in the lake. Maybe if you got in the sauna and didn't get in the lake, that would be harder. Okay. So just as I'm just tying up that piece of work where I'm exploring this notion of eco-dharma and offering it to them, and then we, you know, that then I can go off to my little sabbatical and start handling all these notes that Rob left. So that was on my mind, these epic proportions. What is a story that has big enough proportions that not only can my heart be intact, but can serve as an eye of the soul for self and others in the world? So just as I began, I got to the little caravan and I start reading through the notes again. And they're beautiful in many ways, and you know, Rob wants them published and all of that. But I'm really struggling to get my bearings. Like, where do I begin with this? Realizing that I'm trying to respond, so I took it into practice. I left the notes aside and I sat for a day or something like that. And then I asked myself a question. So as you're trying to find your compass here, sweetheart, what is a good question to ask? What is a good question to ask? And I said, and I asked a question that really resonated with me. And the question is to ask to my heart, what are you faithful to? What are you faithful to? What are you faithful to as I'm trying to respond to all these things? Really, what are you faithful to? And then this is where the writing begins. So not eco-dharma. I ask my heart, what are you faithful to? And 1,000 hidden pockets swell in my chest, and each pocket pops open and arranges their sensitive linings to face outwards, to a scene, to a memory, to a story. What are you faithful to? I ask again. More pockets burst and offer their innermost fabric out to see the same thing, more beautiful now than before. Here, my heart seems to reply, look here. And I linger with the scene. And it is a scene of Rob's deathbed, appearing to me right now like a work of art. Strange this may sound to some, and not strange to others of you. It was sublime in the image, as if every inner surface of my heart is intimately touching and being touched by every facet of the image, the whole image. It feels like on the inside, like being in love with the whole scene. The presence of the full moon over to the right, shining in through the window, commands my attention. And I must confess, it does pique my mind and my poetic sensitivity to know that Rob died at dawn on the Vesak full moon. But I stay mindful. I don't want to flatten this image or the poetry of the cosmos by taking a position here. But what are you in love with? I ask. and the image in my heart lean closer together to hear a recitation. Something is audible. It is a recitation of an image. I am in love with this whole gorgeous poem of an image, reciting itself through its very appearance. But stay close, because Mara is very near. Do you remember Mara? Yes. Mara is near. Ha ha. Mara is near. And I don't only mean Mara, because Mara actually in the tradition means death, actually. I don't mean that. There's two other Maras in the wings in the theatre here. There is Mara the literalist. Have you ever met Mara the literalist? Who traffics in delusion by believing her interpretations. And her twin, Mara the fundamentalist, who is invulnerably assured of his positions on things. Resting on beds of undisclosed assumptions, the cheeky thing. Each Mara stays true to their calling, and each has both a religious and a secular costume, I might add, to wear at different times of day. Mara says, "Don't make something out of this." Now, this idea seemed very, very smart to begin with after Rob died and has been where I have leaned so far. However, under the disguise of wisdom, it renders any discussion mute. Don't make something out of the fact of the full moon, of Vesak and the dawn star. Don't make anything out of that. Okay, I'll be quiet then. A kind of flattening stance, not seeing what might be possible. It is also out of date. Long gone are the days of believing that we have reached that privileged distant view of seeing things as they really are, stripped back and cleansed of our involvement. Don't make something out of this. Of course we're making something out of this, whatever position we take. We invariably make something out of this, even closing the door to the full moon. The timing is still an activity, engaging in making a world. Mara comes back. Ha ha, it's a coincidence. Yes, indeed it is. Many factors have coincided here. This image is resting on multiple conditions. Indeed, it is. All events do. This Mara seems to be purely descriptive at first. It's a coincidence. But the hidden message here is, it is just a coincidence, with the word coincidence embedded in a staunchly Newtonian view of the cosmos. This deflationary and minimizing stance limits the potential and potentially closes the imagination. Of course, inflation is a big problem here and could be a risk. But to be so scared of inflation, like making something, inflating it like a grandiose thing. Of course, inflation is a problem here and could be a risk. But to assume that inflation, to assume inflation as an automatic pathway for someone who wants to linger longer with a beautiful image, this will keep Mara as your guide. If you're so afraid of inflation that you dare not linger with an image, this will keep Mara as your guide. Grrr, says Mara. Mara is snarling at what they think looks like a doorway to metaphysics. Don't go to metaphysics. If you are snarling, I appreciate your staying this far. If you are snarling, I appreciate your staying this far and not leaving the hall yet, and for guarding this doorway. Deconstructing metaphysical meta-narratives has been and is an important offering to our world. But I will have to cast you as Mara in this play if you insist that those who take down the buildings of metaphysics, the edifices of dogma, the edifices of dogmas, to assume that they are the legitimate authority for deciding what new buildings are permitted and what materials those buildings can be made of, this would be a shame. Did you understand that bit? It's quite wordy, isn't it, that bit? If you insist that those who deconstruct all that needed to be deconstructed for us to see its emptiness, including in our own Western historical peace, if we assume that they are the legitimate authority to tell us how we can build and participate in perception, then we miss a trick. Could we at least agree upon the natural human vision to situate ourselves in a bigger picture? That much, perhaps we could agree, our wish to tell ourselves into a bigger story. With what is more than us, without delineating the final parameters or the permitted characteristics of what is more than us. Then there is another Mara. And that Mara comes at the side. But so this must mean, if he died on the full moon, that must mean he's a... Watch out for any recourse to a very quick meaning. Meanings alone do not satisfy a soul, even if they excite the mind. Meanings alone do not satisfy a soul, even if they excite the mind. Claiming that someone is anything in certain terms is rather suspect at the best of times. And here we risk the Mara of naive enchantment, the Mara of naive enchantment, who loses access to critical thinking, who loses access to poetic sensitivity, and tends towards the cultish. When we fail to see our creative part in a supreme story, we lose our sense of humor. When we fail to see our creative part in a supreme story, we lose our sense of humour, and when we lose our sense of humour, the gods definitely vacate the premises. I didn't realise that was funny until just now. That's really good, isn't it? Make of it what you will, this image. Make of it what you will. This seems pretty undogmatic, doesn't it? I have really appreciated it when friends have said this. Make of it what you will, that he died on this sort of famous Buddhist day, at dawn, with the dawn star, with the full moon flooding through the window. Make of it what you will. That's pretty undogmatic. And at least it keeps the door wedged open. But by putting the onus of creating on the humans, make of it what you will. I'll make of it what I will. We might miss a lot about the cosmos. If we reify this position, we will bind ourselves into a postmodern straitjacket and become invulnerable to an encounter with an altogether other intensity. So what if we walk a line here, equipped with our critical discriminating minds and with deep emptiness as our keel. You know that word? Keel? Is that the right word? It is?
Yeah, gully. It's keel. Like if it's the keel of a boat.
Yeah. What if we walk a line here, equipped with our critical discriminating mind, with deep emptiness as our keel, and desire for beauty as our compass, and this is where I do think it's funny, and it might not be now, and a freshly issued poetic license to navigate this vehicle. Let's head out on the sea with the Vaisak full moon to light our way. Okay. might not get to the end and find the truth. That's a joke. So. Beauty. I ask my soul, what is it that you find beautiful in this scene? And all her organs turn their normally innermost private linings out, imperceptibly rubbing and nuzzling every surface like a bee in the pollen. She comes out laden, you know, when a bee has all that stuff on their hairy legs. She comes out laden. So I say, what is it you find beautiful in this scene? She goes in. She comes out laden and says, all of this. She points out, she shows me her saturated furry body. Honestly, I find it beautiful, this scene. Sometimes at night, when I go to sleep, I stay awake a little bit longer and I gaze in my inner eye towards this scene, with my whole body upon this image. It is not a jaw-dropping image of beauty. This one is more of an acquired taste for me. It's not only a visceral and emotional response, if there ever could be such a thing. It is clear that my intellect and my imagination are involved here too. Maybe I could call it art. The immediate presentation strikes me of the image, strikes to me and speaks to me about things that matter deeply to me. And is that perhaps what makes good art? Here's just a short aside. Oh, no. Sorry, I was looking at you like that. I was looking at you. I'll give you the Dharma, please.
I mean, we still have till tomorrow, 11:30.
It's true, we can stay up. Is this what makes good art? At times, when I look upon the scene, I perceive a visual beauty. The moon's way of illuminating that dark room that he was in. The arrangement of the different pieces of the image, the furniture, the people, the windows, the moon, all in relation to each other. And at times when I gaze upon this image, it feels sublime in the sense of being deeply, deeply satisfying to contemplate. There is also a light humour to the whole scene at times, tickling me to look at this elephant in the room, Vesak full moon problem, that it asks me somehow to grapple with a benevolent wink in its eye and a very reassuring sense of humour. And then there is the way this image is brilliant from my perspective, speaking to a number of opposing binaries that afflict and limit. Wondering whether to read it all or
yes.
Okay. Read it all. Okay, take light and dark, for example. Even if intellectually one may no longer assent to the legacy of splitting the light and the dark of the earth and the sky and ascribing the source of holiness upwards, or insist on a reaction that surely it's only downwards, the source of holiness. From the dawn of the Western canon, and lament the way it plays out in the world, even if we do that, this sankhara is powerful, this splitting of the light and the dark. It cannot be sidestepped. And this image of this scene calls to my ethical and aesthetic sensitivity, and as only art can do, opens new vistas and beckons me onward in new ways to understand this split in ways that nothing else can. I have, I think, like others, a desire to see beauty restored from the subsidiary role she is sometimes given, a nice but not wholly necessary added extra, permitted to offer perhaps prettiness or consolation or distraction in a suffering world. Brackets, I know many of you know much more about beauty than that. And I want to see beauty restored to the power that they have to inspire and move us beyond. And in going beyond, thoroughly beyond, that same human soul is somehow graced with what they need to commit to thoroughly stay. In going so deeply beyond that we have what we need to thoroughly stay. I want to know a beauty that includes pain and human suffering, but not only the inclusion of the human heart that is deeply touched by impermanence of life or the loss of a loved one. Yes, that and more. I want beauty to be able to shine in all her brilliance. And this image is that kind of beauty for me. It is redolent with the pain and horror of Rob's dying body and of the suffering of his heart and soul. Rob's death was complex, and his dying in those last 6 weeks was difficult. I think, although I am not an expert, by most standards, it was quite difficult. God love him. It was a terrible ordeal. And I will be better able to do justice to that ordeal in another place. What is speaking to me here is that all of that very particular suffering is somehow important to the image and is woven into this image. That suffering is not at the center of the image, nor is that suffering the cause for being touched by the beauty, as it might be in the arising of compassion, let's say, where suffering is the cause, proximate cause for compassion. In this tragedy, in this image, there is tragedy and confusion here, and there is literally darkness. And I want to know light and dark, not just resolved, not only accepted in a spectrum of light and dark, not only competing with each other over the long arc of history to claim the sort to be the source of life or sacredness. Rob's condition was such that the basement room where he lay was kept as dark as we could possibly make it for those entire 6 weeks. Tragic. I don't know if I explained that, but he had a photosensitivity that was really, really, really hard. Tragic in that he was not so old. He had so much more that he wanted to give. And tragic too in the body and soul stripping ordeal of those last few weeks. And it was confusing in the messiness and the difficulty of handling his complex needs between the six of us untrained people who were with him down there in that dark basement with less professional help, since it coincided precisely with in England during the very first 6 weeks of the COVID, very first COVID lockdown. It was so very human. So very, very human. And on the eve of his death, about midnight, we opened the shutters on the windows for the first time. They had been shut to keep it really, really dark. On the eve of his death, about midnight, we opened the shutters for the first time in weeks, and we checked to see on his face, but it seemed that he was no longer disturbed by the light, and the moon poured in. Whether or not the cosmological significance of the Vaisak moon is important for you. The moon in this image serves at the very least to stretch the frame of our gaze upon this deathbed scene to not only the beloved in the bed, but stretch the scene to the dark night sky and allow the moon to illuminate the whole scene. The presence of the moon places this terribly human and terrestrial event, this terribly human and terrestrial, you know, of the earth. Is that the same word? Yeah. Terrestrial event in not just a larger frame, it does, but more precisely, a beautiful frame, an elegant frame, a frame that does justice to the intelligence and intimacy of an imaginal erotic cosmos. The moon casts the whole scene in the kind of light that you need to be able to see in the dark. The moon casts the whole scene in the kind of light you need to be able to see in the dark, and invites, for those who wish, our participation in the elaboration of the story. Rob, now part of, but no longer at the very center of the image, right? It's really opened. He is important, yes. Beloved, yes. Special, yes. But more compelling than him now is the whole scene. The whole event is framed within that darkened room due to the way it is appearing. Each one of us there appears perfectly proportioned, each one of us in exactly the right place. Perfect, yes, special, yes, beloved, important, yes. The whole scene is beautiful to me. The aesthetics, the angles between things, the arrangements of the parts in relation to each other. Its beauty is new to me. I am both seeing a painting, like a work of art, by a really skilled artist, and I am a character in that painting. This appears to me as a divine work of art. Each person, each thing is valuable and important, and no one person there has more value than another. And this view is not reached by making a horizontal playing field. This view is not reached by assenting to a liberal ideal of equality. As important as that might be, it is not enough for my eros. One's value is derived not by proximity to divinity, nor proximity to the seemingly lead character in the story, nor by dethroning the lead character in the story. The value co-arises with seeing everything there as part of a divine theatre in a divine work of art. Each piece of cosmological furniture, the people we were, the moon, the dark, the hospital bed, the river outside and under his house. This is an image I sit with. I offer it to us if it is an image that stretches or opens anything for you. Or images of your own that draw you in to an eros psyche logos dynamic that makes your address in the cosmos gain epic proportions. Mythic proportions, not grandiose proportions, grand but deeply humble. Whatever calls you to a story that is epic enough, robust enough, intelligent enough, beautiful enough, rich enough, steadying enough, aesthetically open enough. Stay close to that call, and I'll see you there. And I would like to just pause there and then end with a small addendum. And the addendum goes like this. So there's some images there, moonlight. In the Buddhist tradition, the full moon is a symbol of awakening. For me, the full moon is soft and elastic in its possibilities, but let's have awakening as one of them. It's a pretty good one. You know, in the Zen tradition, this image of the full moon, they say, when my house burnt down, I gained an unobstructed view of the full moon. Such is their aesthetic. But let the full moon be everything in this little addendum that I'm going to offer. Full moon be everything that it can be. It's the kind of light that sees in the dark, the kind of gorgeous illumination of things that aren't so obvious. Maybe the kind of light that it lets us see different than the sunlight lets us see, that kind of blasts its brilliance. Different kind of light. I offer the word, this is setting up for the addendum, I offer the word love. This has been a huge theme of our retreat. The Brahmaviharas, the love of the Brahmaviharas. And all the kinds of love that come as we weave with imaginal images. I offer the word romance, because it fits with where I'm going in a minute. But romance really, from the perspective of our retreat, is when Eros is allowed to be Eros in that dynamic, we fall in love. We fall in love again and again and again, and things that we didn't even think could be woven in to make soul that were too outside, too terrible, too beyond. So I offer the word romance as what can be our relationship with being an instrument, a necessary instrument of perception. And I offer the word music as a kind of metaphor for our participation, that agile, kind of intelligent, improvising play as we learn how to practice at all. And learn how to practice with the imaginal. And this is the end part. This is a song that one of my Zen teachers used to sing to us at the end of the evening instead of the refuges. No, he also did the refuges. He also sung this. He's like probably like in his 70s or 80, he's probably 80 something now. And at the time it was cute that he sung it, but it was one of these cheesy American songs from the 50s. Which weren't my cup of tea, you know, that which in a way, in my prejudicial look at those songs, it was like, that's when they had that sort of really idealized view of everything, that splitting of, you know, horror and beauty, blah, 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 in my mind. But I offer it to us now with soft and elastic edges, with the concepts being onward leading, just this tiny verse, it might even be just the chorus. I offer it for our contemplation and for whatever it is that is called upon each of us together, alone, as a community, as a culture, whatever we're asked to do. There may be trouble ahead, but as long as you know it. Do you want to sing it with me?
Yeah.
Is it Moonlight Music, Love and Romance? Yeah. Okay. All right, you ready? Go on. What's a good note for you?
There may be trouble.
There may be trouble ahead.
As long
while there's moonlight
and music and love and romance. Let's face the music and dance.
Before the fiddlers have fled. Before they ask us to pay the bill. But while we still have the chance,
let's face the music and dance. let's sit for a moment with that.
Thank you.